Today is Wednesday, December 22nd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Gina Ruoffo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken rules out face-to-face meetings between Presidents Biden and Putin.
When it comes to Ukraine itself, we've long said that the best way to resolve the conflict and to restore to Ukraine the border that it's entitled to is through the so-called Minsk process.
Plus, President Biden announces plans to deliver 500 million free COVID-19 tests to Americans.
If you're not fully vaccinated, you have good reason to be concerned. You're at a high risk of getting sick. And if you get sick, you're likely to spread it to others, including friends and family.
Also, UN calls on Belarus and Poland to end poor treatment of migrants along their border. Our top story today is in the U.S. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Wednesday said Russia and U.S. negotiators will sit down for talks early next year to discuss Moscow's demand for Western guarantees regarding NATO and Ukraine. Lavrov also said Russia will start separate talks with NATO to discuss the issue. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington expects talks next month, but there are no plans for an in-person meeting between President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Tensions continue to build over a Russian troop buildup on its border with Ukraine. Blinken said the U.S. wants to see Russia de-escalate and to move forces back from the border with Ukraine to take down the tension.
When it comes to Ukraine itself, we've long said that the best way to resolve the conflict and to restore to Ukraine the border that it's entitled to is through the so-called Minsk process, the agreements that Russia and Ukraine reached many years ago now to resolve these differences peacefully. And there, we're very much prepared to try to facilitate that, to act in support of what France and Germany are doing with Russia and Ukraine and what's called the Normandy format. So we're working on all of those lines. Whether that leads to, at some point, another meeting between the president and President Putin, I leave that for another day. There are no plans to do that now. I think we have to see if, in the first instance, there's any progress diplomatically. We also want to see Russia de-escalate, to move forces back from the border with Ukraine, to take down the tension. It's much more appropriate to have a conversation in those circumstances than it is when escalation is happening, not de-escalation.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. President Vladimir Putin said on Tuesday that Russia had no room to retreat in a standoff with the United States over Ukraine and will be forced into a tough response unless the West drops its, quote, aggressive, unquote, line. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin is threatening a tough response if the West does not back down over Ukraine. Moscow has amassed tens of thousands of troops on the border with the former Soviet Republic and is demanding that NATO guarantee it never admit the country into the alliance or deploy weapons or troops there. Speaking to military officials in Moscow on Tuesday, Putin said Russia had no room for retreat.
What they do now on Ukraine territory, or they try to do, they plan to do, is happening not thousands of kilometers from our state border, but at our gates. They must understand that we have nowhere to retreat. Armed conflicts and bloodshed are absolutely not something we would choose. We do not want such a scenario. We want to solve problems using political and diplomatic tools, but also to have explicit, understandable, well-defined legal guarantees.
The U.S. on Tuesday said it was preparing talks with Putin over his security concerns, but many of the Russian leader's demands are seen as non-starters by Washington and its partners. Karen Donfried, the U.S. State Department's top diplomat for Europe, said Washington would continue to send military equipment and supplies to Ukraine. Meanwhile, the U.S. is said to be considering tough export control measures to disrupt Russia's economy if Putin invades Ukraine. A Biden administration official told Reuters the proposed measures would halt Russia's ability to import smartphones, key aircraft and automobile components, and materials from many other sectors. Russia rejects Ukrainian and U.S. accusations that it may be preparing an invasion of Ukraine.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. President Joe Biden urged people to not panic as he announced on Tuesday an updated plan to fight a rise in COVID-19 cases after the emergence of the highly transmissible Omicron variant. He also pleaded with millions of unvaccinated Americans to get their shots. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden said Tuesday he has three tools to fight the rapid spread of COVID-19's formidable Omicron variant. The administration will increase support for hospitals, make half a billion free tests available to Americans, and expand vaccine access. He also encouraged the vaccinated to not panic.
If you're not fully vaccinated, you have good reason to be concerned. You're at a high risk of getting sick. And if you get sick, you're likely to spread it to others, including friends and family. The unvaccinated have a significantly higher risk of ending up in a hospital or even dying. Almost everyone who has died from COVID-19 in the past many months has been unvaccinated. Among the majority of Americans who are fully vaccinated, and especially if you've gotten the booster shot, that third shot, you have much, much less reason to worry.
Biden acknowledged that persuading the holdouts, about 40% of Americans are completely unvaccinated, is an enduring challenge for his administration.
The unvaccinated are responsible for their own choices. Those choices have been fueled by dangerous misinformation on cable TV and social media. You know, these companies and personalities are making money by peddling lies and allowing misinformation that can kill their own customers and their own supporters. It's wrong. It's immoral. I call on the purveyors of these lies and misinformation to stop it. Stop it now.
In recent days, an unlikely pro-vaccine ally has emerged, former President Donald Trump. He recently admitted he had received a booster shot and was booed for it by some of his followers.
Maybe one of the few things he and I agree on. People with booster shots are highly protected. Join them. Join us.
But critics say this push for boosters is unjust when many around the world have yet to get a single shot. On Tuesday, the One Campaign, a health policy advocacy organization, warned that there is no way to hit the target of vaccinating 40% of the world's population by the end of the year, and that it could take more than a decade for low-income countries to match the vaccination levels of high-income countries. Tom Hart is head of the organization.
We are absolutely not winning the global war against the pandemic, as evidenced by Omicron. But of course, Delta showed us that, and the original virus showed us that. The lack of global leadership, the lack of coordinated leadership among countries, the knee-first reaction by every government leader during the first 2 years of this pandemic has meant that it has continued on longer at the cost of more lives and more livelihoods. It's very clear what needs to happen. A national-only strategy will not work.
Critics also decry wealthy nations for hoarding essential supplies. On Tuesday, Biden defended the U.S. decision to stockpile protective equipment and ventilators as necessary to prepare for a run on hospitals. This week, as Americans stare down this threat, Biden sought to put a balm on his weary nation.
I know you're tired. I really mean this, and I know you're frustrated. We all want this to be over. We're still in it. This is a critical moment. We also have more tools than we ever had before. We're ready. We'll get through this.
Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is set to authorize COVID-19 treatment pills from both Pfizer, Inc. and Merck. As early as Wednesday, Bloomberg News reported on Tuesday, citing people familiar with the matter. The two drugs, Pfizer's pill Paxlovid and Merck's Molnupiravir, are seen as promising new oral treatments that can be taken upon onset of symptoms at home to help prevent COVID-19 hospitalization and deaths. However, on Wednesday, Reuters News said French health officials canceled an order for Merck's drug because of what they call disappointing trial data. Merck test data suggests it prevents hospitalizations and deaths by about 30%. The Pfizer drug appears to cut hospitalization and death by about 90%. As Americans enter the holiday season, the U.S. supply chain is plagued with delays in moving goods from ports, warehouses, and onto stores and consumers. A shortage of truck drivers is often given as a reason. As Michael Sullivan reports, some experts and drivers see another pervasive problem, a lack of coordination along the supply chain.
Backups at ports and long waits at warehouses. A shortage of 80,000 truckers compounds the problem, says the American Trucking Associations, an industry trade group. Another factor, truckers are not efficiently deployed, says an academic researcher, because they average 6.5 hours of driving each day of the 11 they are permitted. A Los Angeles trucker named Bill, an immigrant from China who only wants his first name used, visits the port every day.
When low, we sometimes wait for the 6 hour to 9 hour. Yes, sometimes very, very bad.
Do you make money when you wait?
Oh, lose money, you know. Everybody lose money.
Truckers can also face long waits at warehouses. Marian, a Romanian immigrant who only wants his first name used, is a long-haul trucker from Chicago.
Sometimes it's a matter of how those companies are organized, how well their employees are trained, how much they care about what they're doing, and the fact that we have to also make money.
Truckers can earn good money, so many want to enter the industry, says the owner of a school that trains truck dispatchers. But students must decide if they're willing to undertake the demanding work. The Biden administration hopes to meet the shortfall by expanding apprentice programs and training military veterans as truckers. But turnover is high, and another analyst says we need to ask why. Some of them operate heavy equipment, while others have moved to industries like construction, frustrated with inflexible driving rules, telling them when to sleep, for example, even if they cannot find a safe place to do it.
It happened to me when I had to stop to two, three different places and I couldn't find a parking space after 6 o'clock at night.
Marianne says he enjoys life on the road, but hears complaints from fellow truckers. So does sociologist Steve Vaselli.
There's a lot of frustration, you know, a lot of a sense of disrespect. Drivers talk a lot about, you know, respect.
Vaselli says truckers want respect for their time and professionalism as they haul critical goods across the country. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Scientists at a California company are using biotechnology to create an eco-friendly dye as an alternative to the toxic dyes typically used in the production of denim. VOA's Julie Tabor has more.
Despite its classic look, the blue dye used to manufacture denim can be hard on the environment and potentially toxic to workers, some researchers say. Scientists at a company in Berkeley, California, have come up with what they say is an eco-friendlier dye inspired by Mother Nature. They study enzymes that plants use to produce color and program microbes in their lab to mimic that process. The Japanese indigo plant, for example, makes the blue dye molecule in its leaves. Hugh co-founder Tammy Sue.
So we've taken the genetic information from the plant and used it to inform and program our microbes. And so here we have microbes growing on a plate where they're producing indigo in the same way that the dye plant would make indigo.
The researchers grow the microbes in a liquid culture where they replicate and divide to produce the indigo color.
So here we begin the process of developing out how to best grow our microbes, so it's producing the largest amount of dye.
The fabric is soaked in the dye bath and placed on a fabric pattern.
And here's the final dyed fabric. This is one of the first Hue indigo dyed lab coats that we made.
Michelle Zhu is the CEO and co-founder of Hue. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
With the advancements in bioengineering and biotechnology, there really is an opportunity to clean up and change these traditional industries for good.
While Hugh started his program with indigo for denim, the company plans to create more color options and expand to other industries.
So whether that be for the clothes that we wear, the food that we eat, or the paint on our walls, color is everywhere, and Hugh is creating it in a better way, powered by biotechnology.
Hugh plans to have its eco-friendly products available to consumers within the next few years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
UN human rights officials are calling on Sudanese authorities to bring to justice those members of the security forces found guilty of sexually assaulting several women and girls during demonstrations held Sunday in the capital, Khartoum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
What began as a peaceful protest quickly turned into a chaotic scene of sexual violence, harassment, and deadly force. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says UN monitors in Sudan have received reports 13 women and girls were victims of rape or gang rape during a recent demonstration.
We've also received allegations of sexual harassment by security forces against women who were trying to flee the area around the presidential palace on Sunday evening. Two protesters died after being shot and around 300 others were injured, some due to the use of live ammunition, some hit by tear gas canisters or beaten by security forces, and others who suffered breathing difficulties from tear gas inhalation.
Tens of thousands of people took part in demonstrations marking the third anniversary of protests that led to the overthrow of the government of President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. Demonstrators also gathered to protest the military coup in October and the political agreement that was signed in November. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Sudanese authorities to investigate the allegations of rape and sexual harassment promptly and thoroughly. Throssell says the alleged deaths and injury of protesters, because of the disproportionate use of force and live ammunition, also must be investigated.
The perpetrators must be identified and prosecuted. With further protests planned for this weekend and the weeks ahead, it is crucial that security forces guarantee and protect the right to peaceful assembly and act with full respect for international laws and standards regulating the use of force.
Throssell notes the country's acting attorney general has set up a committee of senior prosecutors to investigate all human rights violations committed since the military coup on October 25th. The UN Human Rights Office is urging national authorities to make the committee findings public and to hold to account those responsible for human rights violations and abuses. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Dutch prosecutors have demanded life sentences against four suspects in the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine in 2014. Prosecutors say they recklessly used the Russian missile to bring down the passenger jet, killing all 298 passengers and crew. Public prosecutor Manon Redebeck made the sentence demand Wednesday at the end of a three-day presentation of evidence. The suspects have been tried in absentia. A Thai army officer said fighting between Myanmar government forces and ethnic guerrillas have sent about 4,200 villagers fleeing across the border into Thailand over the past week. That number includes more than 2,500 who fled into Thailand on Friday from territory held by the ethnic Karen minority. A similar wave took place in April when several thousand villagers from Myanmar's eastern state of Karen fled following airstrikes by the Myanmar government. The Karen are one of several ethnic minorities that have been battling for decades for greater autonomy from Myanmar's central government. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Opo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Belarus and Poland to end what it calls appalling treatment of refugees and migrants stranded along their common border and to live up to their obligations under international human rights and refugee laws. Again, Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
A UN human rights team visited the region between November 29th and December 3rd to get a first-hand view of the situation. While Polish officials met with the team, Belarusian authorities did not. UN human rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says team members were not granted access to the restricted border area. However, she says they interviewed government officials, civil society representatives, and dozens of refugees and migrants who had arrived in Poland through Belarus. Those interviewed, she says, described the dire conditions on both sides of the border.
The majority said that while in Belarus, they had been beaten or threatened by security forces, and also alleged that the Belarusian security forces forced them to cross the border. Several interviewees said Belarusian security forces had demanded extortionate sums for food and water. They spoke about their fear about being alone in the forest, fear about, even fear of dying because of the difficult conditions there. And one of the migrants said, it's absolute hell for everyone.
The International Organization for Migration says 21 migrants have died along the Belarus-EU border, many from hypothermia because of freezing temperatures. The European Commission accuses Belarus of creating a crisis by luring migrants from the Middle East, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and other countries to the capital, Minsk, with the false promise of gaining easy entry to the European Union. Throssell says neither Belarus nor Poland wants the refugees and migrants and push them across borders. She says Poland also systematically detains those whom it has not returned to Belarus.
Many of those interviews said they had not been given proper physical and mental health care in detention and had limited contact with the outside world, including with independent lawyers, human rights monitors, and civil society organizations. We remind Poland that detention should be an exceptional measure of last resort and only be used for a limited period of time, if at all.
The UN Human Rights Office is urging authorities of both countries to give human rights and humanitarian actors, as well as journalists, lawyers, and civil society representatives, access to the border areas. It is calling on them and on the EU to respect and protect the human rights of migrants in line with international law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
During a visit to Lebanon that ends Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres went to the site of Beirut's explosion and laid a wreath of flowers. He said, quote, "The Lebanese have a right to know the truth," unquote, about the explosion that rocked the port of Beirut on August 4, 2020, killing 200 people. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi and Ahmed Fati, a UN correspondent and global affairs analyst, discussed the message Guterres was sending to the political establishments in Lebanon.
I believe the strongest message Secretary General Guterres have sent to the Lebanese politicians and the ruling class there, that the international community, the United Nations, have seen how Lebanon and the Lebanese political class dealt with the tribunal investigating the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, where they could not even convict anybody. So I think the Secretary General Guterres sending a clearer message to the political establishment in Lebanon that they don't have the right to divide and paralyze the country as the way they have been prolonging. The Lebanon now does not have a functioning government as we know it. Their economy is in free fall, and it's been described even by the World Bank as the worst economic crisis since 1850. Add to that, Lebanon division of its population along sectarian line. It is not going further, especially under the economic meltdown that they are experiencing, that it is going to be a country on the verge of disintegrate. That's what the Secretary General had in mind when he was conveying his message to the political establishment.
Guterres confronted the fact that the investigation was hampered by saying, "An impartial and transparent investigation into this tragic event is crucial to ensure justice," hinting that the probe entrusted to Judge Tariq Bitar has been so far hindered by the entire political class in power. He added that the judge was unable to question any of the high-level political, institutional, and security leaders suspected of responsibility of the explosion. How significant is such a candid criticism of the way the investigation was handled?
The United Nations have very good experience with the Lebanese judicial establishment, and it have also a very good experience with the political ruling class in Lebanon. We all remember that back in 2009, when the tribunal established to indict those who were suspected of committing the assassination of the prime minister, and it lasted for 11 years, was not able at the end to convict anybody. I hope it's not the same scenario in the Beirut port investigation, because this has been hampering any chance of bringing to place a rule of law. We all know that in Lebanon, the political establishment in the parliament, as long as on the ground, is divided along sectarian lines. Add to that, that there is a metaphor, which is a hypermart for proxies. Many regional powers have proxies on the ground in Lebanon. Probably the most obvious is Iran and Hezbollah, which is considered an outline in the open proxy for Iran. And then you have these proxies for the Saudis, Emiratis, etc. So it is a kind of peculiar situation to operate in a political format. I don't think that the international community has much patience left for this warlords and operatives and tribal in such a small country that is threatening to blow the situation in a very critical part of the world that it is already on a barrel of powder. So I think that what the Secretary General have meant, that they need to let the legal process proceed, that the doing business the same old way along the division of powers and positions in Lebanon is not going to be sustainable any longer.
That's VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi speaking with Ahmed Fati, a UN correspondent and global affairs analyst. A Libyan parliamentary committee says it has become impossible to hold a long-awaited presidential election in 2 days as scheduled. The widely expected announcement was the first official statement that the vote would not happen on Friday after calls mounted for a delay. the country's Electoral Commission had failed to name a final list of candidates, and it disbanded electoral committees late Tuesday. Hundreds of people have put themselves forward as candidates, including several high-profile ones who were banned from the race. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.